From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's Editor-in-Chief John Sterling talks to Dr. Sharon Moalem, the author of a new book entitled Survival of the Sickest, A Medical Maverick Discovers Why We Need Disease.
Dr. Sharon Moalem is a researcher at New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He received his Ph.D. in neurogenetics and evolutionary medicine from the University of Toronto. His studies uncovered a new genetic association for familial Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Moalem has published papers on a wide variety of topics, from what happens to honeybees when they get sick, to the evolutionary adaptive advantages of both hemochromatosis and diabetes. Dr. Moalem is the author of the recently published book, Survival of the Sickest, A Medical Maverick Discovers Why We Need Disease. It examines connections between evolution, disease, and human health today. Dr. Moalem, what's the major premise of survival of the sickest?
Well, it's a basic idea that through evolution, we evolved to have disease. And this is counterintuitive because most people consider the phrase survival of the fittest, and they think of fittest to be some kind of level of perfection. Yet so many things on the planet are struggling to survive, and eventually we have to come up with kind of these Faustian bargains, these difficult compromises. And I believe one of them is the majority of common diseases that we still face today actually either served a purpose in the past or still today provide us some degree of protection, help us to survive.
Now, that sort of gets to my next question, because in your book you write, one generation's evolutionary solution is another generation's evolutionary problem, especially when people no longer live in the environment that their bodies adapted to through evolution. Can you elaborate on that statement a bit?
Sure. So take, for example, the Pima Indians who live in the southwestern United States. Today they have one of the highest rates worldwide of diabetes, which is over 50%, and an even greater number of them are overweight and obese. And when you ask the question why, you see that up until very recently, the Pimas didn't have the diet that they're eating today. They essentially ate what would be called akin to an Atkins diet. They were doing a lot of hunting and fishing. And when the government put them on a reservation and gave them all the food that they needed, in fact, they actually gave them the wrong food. They didn't evolve over time to be able to break down so many carbs. They were given essentially, the modern farmer's diet with a lot of carbohydrates. So the idea is that over time, their bodies evolved to handle a specific diet. And yet today, given the new diet that they're eating, this puts them at risk for diseases such as diabetes.
Now, in your book, you give a number of examples of these, I guess at one point, an evolutionary solution that's now become a problem, and I want to explore some of these. So the first is that you note that many Europeans inherit a genetic disorder called hemochromatosis, which leads to high levels of iron in their major organs, a potentially fatal condition. What's the evolutionary advantage of having this disease or the genes being around?
Well, I asked myself exactly that question as I was researching the genes involved in hemochromatosis. I couldn't understand why people of a Western European descent would have so many copies of these genes. I mean, 30% in parts of the UK, it's up to 40% of the population have genes that can result in too much iron. And I through some research came up with the idea that it must have protected populations, especially against pathogens that seek iron. And the one big example is the plague. Yersinia pestis loves iron and needs it to survive. And people with this condition have a part of their immune system that lacks iron, and that makes them better at fighting these kinds of infections. So this is just one example that, through the past, so many people died because of the plague. Well, the ones who survived had something something that the ones who died didn't. And I believe that one of these survival advantages is hemochromatosis, this ability to absorb too much iron from the diet. The only problem is today, in a very iron-rich diet and not having to deal with the plague, you run the risk of resting to death, of absorbing too much iron from your diet, which can lead to things such as liver cancer or diabetes.
Now, according to your book, a great majority of people with type 1 diabetes come from Northern Europe. What's the environment health disease link here?
Well, that one's fascinating. My interest really became sparked when I came across a frog called Rana sylvatica, the common wood frog. And this frog has an especial ability to manage the cold. And what it does, it becomes diabetic. Every winter, you know, coming in when the temperature drops, the sugar levels of this frog spikes something as high as 100 times as normal. And it does this to manage the cold, and effectively it freezes. It freezes solid, becomes a frogsicle. Its brain stops working, its heart stops beating, and remains frozen all through the winter. And then come spring, it thaws out, and its diabetes reverses. And it does this to prevent the damages that usually happens when something freezes. A high level of sugar, first of all, lowers the freezing point, so you can survive longer with during cold temperatures. And it prevents it from getting too many ice crystals forming that can, like, puncture organs. So how does this work with type 1 diabetes? Well, type 1 diabetes is very common for people with genetic disorder, that people from Northern European descent. And it's got me thinking that maybe the origins of this disease, not having enough insulin, would be somewhat protective, especially when you have to deal with the cold. And there was a snap ice age called a Younger Dryas 14,000 years ago, and that caught populations living in Europe essentially off guard. So, you know, not being able to build proper shelter against the cold, the one thing that would help would be if your sugar levels spike. And actually, you don't even need diabetes to observe this effect. Take anyone who's healthy, you expose them to the cold, and the first thing that happens is their sugar levels spike. And actually, most people's sugar levels are higher in the wintertime. And again, this is just the response to the cold because, as you know, when there is higher amounts of sugar in a liquid, that lowers its freezing point. Just the same way, you know, as a Slurpee or a Slushie.
I see. Now, would you talk about the evolutionary trade-off involving the APOE4 gene and vitamin D production and the risk for developing heart disease, stroke, and even Alzheimer's?
Sure. Well, this one's fascinating. Again, you know, it's one gene that seems to have a specific geographic location. And if you map this gene in Europe, what you'll find is that Northern Europeans tend to have the highest rates of this gene, and Southern Europeans the least. And the result of having this specific genotype means that you're going to have higher levels of cholesterol in your blood. Well, what would be the benefit of having too much cholesterol? Having a lot of cholesterol would allow you to make vitamin D when there's not enough sun, because your body actually converts cholesterol into vitamin D using the energy from the sun. So areas in Northern Europe where there's not enough sun, having that extra cholesterol because of this gene would be beneficial. The only problem, as we well know, is having too much cholesterol long-term can lead to such problems as heart disease, stroke, and as well, this is one of the only genes that have been really robustly associated with Alzheimer's as a risk factor. So this is kind of like a trade-off for living in an area in the world when there's not enough sun.
Now, also, too, in your book, didn't you also say that if you take your cholesterol readings, you know, today, you go to a doctor, they tend to be higher in the fall as there's less light than there is the rest of the year?
Exactly. So for, you know, the longest time, people kind of thought maybe this is just a diet related. Maybe you're just eating, festive foods in December that have a lot more fat in them. But it's actually the result of the sun. So being exposed to sunlight allows your body to make vitamin D and lowers the cholesterol. So if you're going to be treated for high cholesterol, you really should be tested in more than one season to get a good kind of diagnosis and good idea of what's going on in your body.
See. Now, what's the evolutionary advantage of our genome containing so much non-coding or so-called junk DNA, again, in relation to health and disease?
Well, I mean, this is fascinating. Up until recently, it was thought that the majority of our DNA was just junk. Well, it turns out that these so-called jumping genes might have the ability to make copies of other genes. And the way this could work is, I'll just give you, one example. There's a gene that's associated with being able to break down pharmaceutical drugs. And if you study biology or you just have a very brief understanding of it, you'd know that we get two copies of each gene, one from our mother and father. Yet the surprising thing is we're finding some people have up to 14 copies or of specific genes or even more. And what this means is that it allows them to break down a lot more poison, say, in the environment if you have the specific gene. And you're called a fast metabolizer. So it means that you break down drugs very quickly. So you actually need more. And the reverse is if you don't have many copies of this gene or the copies that you do have don't work so well, then you'll be a slow metabolizer. And then you can have bad side effects from up to about 25% of pharmaceutical drugs. And many people that have problems with over-the-counter cold medications or caffeine are probably slow metabolizers. And the benefit is to tell your physician immediately because, this could put you at risk for other complications from drugs that they might prescribe.
Now, my final question, based on all the examples you give in the book concerning the impact of evolution and genetics on health and the varying incidence of different diseases around the world, how can this knowledge be used practically in scientific research and also in the practice of, I guess, what's been called Darwinian medicine?
Yeah, well, it can help, but I think because the biggest problem is, I believe, is that we've declared war on disease without really understanding who the enemy is. And by sitting back and reverse engineering a disease, asking how did this common disorder arise in the first place? Could it have been protective against something? This can lead you down a new path and avenue of research that you may not have considered initially. And the one example that I always think about is back to that wood frog. You would never look to a frog for a cure or treatment for diabetes. So kind of reconceiving of illness and disease as an evolutionary compromise allows you to find new ways to understand that disease, which obviously in the end will help you to find a new way to treat it.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your thoughts on some of the points discussed during this week's podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. In his book, Dr. Moalem tries to answer a key question. If natural selection is supposed to get rid of harmful genetic traits, why are hereditary diseases so common? Dr. Moalem says modern medicine does not really understand why many diseases appear to be wired into our genetic code, and that this handicaps the medical establishment's ability to help us lead longer and healthier lives. How might better insights into so-called Darwinian medicine and a greater appreciation of evolutionary explanations for why people are vulnerable to various diseases improve the practice of medicine? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Next week's guest, William Caldwell, CEO of Advanced Cell Technology Incorporated. The topic, human embryonic stem cells. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.